This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Fall of Boomtown. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
With a sharp drop in oil prices, the once red-hot city of Williston, North Dakota is going through another transformation. We'll explain what's happening.
If you need knee replacement surgery, does it make sense to do both at the same time? We'll explore the pluses and minuses.
With the NFL playoffs in mind this weekend, to look at the most frugal team in pro football. You'll hear the money habits of its star players.
And the newest expense for college athletics, appearance.
It's not just the top-tier programs. You know, our story includes everywhere from Auburn, you know, a premier SEC football school, to, Western Michigan spending quite a bit of money on this to promote their new football coach.
Rachel Axon at USA Today on what schools are spending to dress up their athletics appearance to be as competitive as possible. Her report in about 20 minutes. Well, how the mighty have fallen. Tim Marson at International Business Times writes that it's arguable that no city in the U.S. has seen more change in the past half decade than Williston, North Dakota, with billions of barrels of oil suddenly recoverable from the rock formation beneath it. Williston went from an afterthought, another dot in an oft-forgotten state, to the epicenter of an exploding industry. But things have changed with the recent plummet in oil prices. He visited Williston. Tim, what'd you find?
You know, before the oil boom, it was kind of a small town, and then the boom hit, and that small town grew probably faster and at a pace you can't really imagine. At some point, rents were outpacing New York City, the average salary went crazy, and, you know, people flooded in because oil brings a lot of money, and people want to come make these crazy salaries and, you know, work long days in the oil fields. But as that kind of went away and as oil has fallen off, you know, as far as prices go worldwide, a lot of people have left. A lot of the temporary workers, especially, that lived in these camps outside of town ended up leaving, and life's kind of gotten harder for a town that was a boom town, you know, just last year.
Right. I envision small businesses taking hits, restaurants, things like that. Is that the case in Williston?
Sure. Retail's been down. Restaurants have been down. One of the areas that's been hit really hard is real estate, because, you know, they built these new apartments and, you know, they had these new hotels as well for, you know, this influx of people. And they expected, you know, more people to keep coming for years. And when you build with that in mind, you know, now they're at like 50% vacancy for their hotels and apartments.
Wow. All right. So that means what going forward? I mean, what happens to a town that goes through this?
Well, I think that's kind of the big question. And, you know, I guess it's up to kind of the leaders of the town to decide, you know, what they want this town to be. And if oil prices come back up, you know, maybe the industry will come back. But I think the long-term plan is kind of a tough proposition, because you got to try to hope to balance the town's future. You know, oil can be a great thing and can bring a lot of growth, but they're trying to figure out ways to exist outside of that.
Yeah. We're speaking with Tim Marson, breaking news reporter at International Business Times. We're talking about his feature on Williston, North Dakota, and the rise and fall of an oil boomtown. Is there a chance, I guess, or is there reason to expect that there might be some rebound?
I mean, I guess there's reason to expect that, or reason to think that could happen. And if you talk to officials within the town, that they're especially hopeful. I think a lot of people don't think it's going to rebound to the glory days. I don't think anybody's really expecting that, where oil was more than $100 per barrel and, you know, it was this gold rush town. But they're hoping for oil to come back reasonably. But I think that boom town that kind of captured the imagination of a lot of people, you know, might be gone.
Yeah. What were these camps outside of town that you talked about? What were they like?
Well, back in the day, you know, they kind of held that reputation for housing these kind of young oil men with, you know, I think I said more money than sense in the story. And, you know, the town got a little bit dangerous for a while. And, you know, that was kind of the reputation. And with time, you know, they kind of sanitized, and they became, you know, just a place where people went to sleep in between working these long shifts, and now they've kind of emptied out, and the town's actually debating whether or not they're going to push all these camps out and try to get people to move back into those empty apartments and hotels in town.
What kind of camps, though? I mean, actual, like, tent setups and stuff?
No. It's not like actual camps, at least, you know, the one I spent some time in, you know, it's these kind of like these big trailers with TVs and, you know, a nice kitchen. And, you know, if you picture, I guess, you know, dorm style living in college, it's a lot like that, but, you know, new nice dorms that the college just put up.
Gotcha. What's happened to the population there?
The population's gone down. That's always been tough to peg within Williston because there's always been temporary workers. The best way to do it is actually water flow, but the population's gone down, and especially the temporary population of, you know, workers who were coming trying to make the oil money.
Yeah. Folks came from all over the country, didn't they, to pick up work there?
Yeah. I'd been out there before, and, they came out, you know, and you couldn't really have a conversation there without, you know, somebody floating the idea of the American dream. And people wanted to come out there, and they wanted to work hard and try to make their fortune. And people are still doing that, maybe to a lesser extent. They're learning that the town's changed, but, you know, people are still trying to come out there, and they're finding that Boomtown isn't necessarily what it was, you know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago.
I'd imagine some people went in, scored well, and then left before things started to fall apart, no?
I'm sure there were some people who did well, and, you know, work singular workers, and some, you know, companies who might have come in and done well and then left. Some folks who tried to plan something that was, you know, a 5-year return on investment, you know, something pretty quick, have been left hanging still, and are trying to figure that out. But yeah, so some people, of course, you know, as with any Boomtown, somebody's going to come in and somebody's going to make money.
All right, thanks, Tim. Tim Marson from International Business Times. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. The holidays are over, so why don't you treat yourself to something nice and make a visit to All and Sundry, a modern men's shoe company with an old world vision. You've heard me talk about my friend Nick and his team and how they make the finest handcrafted custom shoes. Well, they want to extend an invite to those of you in the New York City area to their showroom in the Flatiron District. They'll take great care of you, and it'll be a truly unique experience. You get to select your style of shoe, whether for work or play. They source all the materials and build each one by hand. And without a middleman, you get the savings. No more outrageous markups. If you're a shoe guy, All in Sundry is for you. If you're not a shoe guy, you might change your mind after visiting the team at All in Sundry. Visit allinsundry.com, too, to set up an appointment or speak to a team member on the best way to create your shoes. You'll even get a discount when you enter code DEAL online or mention it to a team member when setting up an appointment. Don't wait. Reach out today and get the very best in affordable, handcrafted shoes. All in Sundry. If you or a loved one needs knee replacement surgery, what about doing both at the same time for just one surgery instead of two? Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landro says with knee replacement surgery on the rise, more patients with two bad knees are opting for a controversial procedure that replaces both at the same time. She's got a look at what's called simultaneous bilateral knee replacement. Laura, take us through it.
You know that knee replacement is now probably among the most, if not the most, common procedure for people over a certain age. And it's getting younger, actually, in the United States. And a lot of people don't just have one bad knee, they have two bad knees. So one of the decisions that they have to make, that's available to them to make, is whether to get them both done at once rather than have one done, go through the whole rehabilitation, have a second hospital stay, do it all over again. So there's a lot of argument among some orthopedic surgeons that the way to go, if you're in good health, is to do this all at once, get it over with.
Wow. Does that mean that you're having both done, say, even if one knee doesn't necessarily mean it?
No. It's strictly for people who are going to need both knees replaced.
Okay.
It doesn't mean, well, while I'm in here, I'll just have another one done just for the heck of it. No, it's pretty much for people who need what they call a bilateral knee replacement. Both knees have worn out.
Okay, so the doctor is predicting that somewhere along the line, you're going to have that second one done. Why not do it now?
Exactly, okay. And probably sooner rather than later. Although, you know, people do wait. So it's a big, big debate, and I was surprised to learn how much of a debate it is within the orthopedic community, One doctor I spoke to said, no way, I don't do it. It's too much of a risk. Others said, you know, with the right people, this can be the right thing to do. And two patients that I spoke to really had a good experience. I mean, it was no day at the beach, obviously. You're still undergoing major surgery, and you've got a, you know, 3 or 4 months before you're completely back to normal. But a lot of them have said, I just wanted to get it done. I didn't want to, you know, take that much time off twice.
Right.
People are too busy.
Who's the right candidate for this?
Well, that's interesting. You know, one of the most important things is that you have to be in good health. So they don't want to do this on people who have cardiac risks. They don't want to do it on people that have a body mass index of over 40, which sort of qualifies, you know, as obese. You know, people with obesity obviously have other things like diabetes, heart disease, things that increase the risk for surgery. And doing surgery on very overweight patients is also risky. It carries other kinds of risk. It's more complex. So they're basically looking that you're healthy, you've stayed in shape, you've got no heart disease, you don't have a lot of what they call comorbidities that can complicate things, and you're ready to do the work, you know, leading up to and afterwards for the recovery.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Her piece is called Why Double Knee Replacement Might Be Best. All right, so recovery and rehab, I presume, are different.
Well, you know, the most important thing, by the way, to know is that you have to really look at, you know, if you're interested in research, there are some studies that show there's no real difference in complication rates after bilateral surgery compared with having one knee done at once. What they haven't done is compare having both knees done at once to having one knee done now and one knee done later. So there aren't as many good studies out there about the recovery. But what they have found is that the recovery period afterwards, you have to spend, you know, about this, you know, maybe 3 days in the hospital instead of 2 for getting your knee replaced.
Right.
A lot of patients who have their knee replaced have to go to rehabilitation if they get both knees for a week. Whereas if you've had one knee replaced, you don't go to a rehabilitation center for a week. You just go home and start working on things and going to physical therapy. So initially, you might have a little more time incarcerated, you know, in a healthcare institution,
right.
And you might have a 4-month recovery as opposed to maybe something a little shorter for one knee, but you don't have to go back and do it all over again.
Right. All right. What about the costs here? Is that a factor?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I think that insurers are paying for this now is because the costs are considerably less. I think, you know, one study was comparing the average, you know, the mean cost for, you know, simultaneous bilateral surgery, it's something like $43,000, you know, compared with $72,000 for two separate surgeries staged over time. So, you know, I think Medicare and the insurance companies are covering this because they actually, when they're both done on the same day, they can also pay the surgeons, you know, less. Sometimes you have two surgeons working on you, by the way. Sometimes one surgeon will complete one and then turn around and do the other while, you know, part of the team is sewing up the other leg. So, you know, it's definitely costs less, according to these kind of cost-effectiveness analysis studies that have been out there. You know, the question is whether you are willing to take the higher risk. And the higher risks include, you know, death, pulmonary embolisms. That's when a blood clot travels to your lung. There have been shown to be higher risks of this when you have both done it once. But again, overall complications in knee surgery are not that high, but there is a higher risk with this one.
Thanks, Laura. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. College athletics programs are going to another level in trying to get the slightest advantage over a rival. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
There's new ammunition in the arms race in college football. Flashy graphics. Programs large and small are spending millions to attract recruits and donors with colorful displays in their facilities. Rachel Axon of USA Today, who spent some time investigating this new trend, is here with more. Rachel, first of all, who's doing this?
Well, the short answer is not almost everybody, but many people. It's not just the top-tier programs. You know, our story includes everywhere from Auburn, you know, a premier SEC football school, to, you know, Western Michigan spending quite a bit of money on this to promote their new football coach. So, you know, you're seeing it more at the top in the Power Five conferences, but definitely not exclusively.
What kind of graphics are we talking about here? What do they look like?
Yeah, so this is a hard thing to get, that we want to make clear. This isn't, you know, like banners that you see hanging in the rafters of an arena or a basketball gym or something like that. These are highly designed, you know, kind of often life-size, covering whole walls, displays where, you know, they're highlighting former players, a coaching philosophy, success of the program. So it's less a poster on a wall than a graphic on the entire wall.
Rachel, are these just for stadiums?
No, actually, that's one of the things that's really interesting about this. You know, certainly stadiums are done, and we kind of tried to make a distinction between public-facing spaces, you know, something that a fan would go and interact with, or, you know, your average student on campus. And increasingly more and more, this is happening in sort of the team-exclusive spaces. So indoor practice facilities are a great example of that. Those are only utilized by, you know, traditionally football teams and that coaching staff. So Auburn, for example, has spent more than $800,000 to put graphics in a building that, you know, about 150 people on campus typically use. So that raises a lot of questions about, you know, what is the benefit of doing this?
You mentioned in your story that it also can be used to attract donors. How so?
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting that we couldn't get into as much with the spaces, you know, everything that traditionally an athlete would see, a donor will probably see. You know, if you donate enough money to a school, you've been in their practice facility, you've been in their locker room, you know what's there. And they want to see, you know, this kind of first-class look is what, you know, a lot of ADs said, where the program looks well, and also that the tradition and the history and the success is highlighted through those graphics.
Are there companies that are specializing in college branding?
Yeah, there were three. I mean, there's many, but there were three that we focused on. Advent, which is based in Nashville, 49 Degrees, which is based in Ohio, and Rainier Sports, which is based in Washington. And they really, part of the story is they made this their business. You know, these are companies that traditionally would have done, you know, indoor signage for corporate environments or retail environments or things like that. And starting about 7-8 years ago, they kind of pivoted to this is primarily the work that they do.
I would imagine that there is some pushback at schools for spending this kind of money on pictures.
I would imagine that. I think that was kind of the initial question that we started from, because we've come across some records that these were being put in an indoor practice facility. You know, in a lot of ways, you can measure or try to measure the results of things. If you redo a weight room, you know, something that's traditionally viewed as can be gold plating, you know, there's a tangible, or should be a tangible, outcome that you can measure. Your athletes get stronger. If you hire, you know, a top coach, he will be judged by a win-loss record. This one, it's more gray in terms of, okay, we're spending this money, but what are we getting? And the thing that they kept coming back to was, you know, recruiting.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Rachel Axon at USA Today. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, what some golf courses consider conservation for tax breaks. One great resolution you can make for the new year: maximize every minute and every dollar for your small business. I know an easy way to do that. It's stamps.com. Think about how much time you've wasted going to the post office. One, driving there. Two, finding parking. Stamps.com is the better way to get postage. Just use what you already have, your own computer and printer, to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then the mailman picks it up. With Stamps.com, everything you would do at the post office, you can do right from your desk, and at a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Stamps.com is great and easy to use, and it's so convenient. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Then before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's stamps.com and enter code Deal. The IRS is taking a good hard look at a number of golf courses these days, trying to figure out which ones are taking advantage of an environmental incentive that lets them deduct millions of dollars in tax breaks for, quote, conservation. More from Wall Street Journal tax writer Richard Rubin, who found one expert who says some clubs claim every inch, the greens, the fairways, the tees, the boxes, and the trails, even if they were paved. Rich, how do they do that?
They have a couple of different ways they can justify it. They can try and say it's a natural habitat. They can say that it preserves open space and under certain circumstances. And they've succeeded in the past. So there was a case out of Alabama a few years ago where the IRS basically said, yeah, that counts as a natural habitat because it doesn't allow construction to happen. And the main habitat that's provided is a stopping point for migratory birds. And so... yeah, it actually qualifies. And what happened in this case that I wrote about in the story is the tax court carving that back a bit and looking at a North Carolina golf course or two and saying that there just wasn't enough important habitat there.
Wow. All right. So are all golf courses trying to pull this off in some way, shape, or form, or not all of them?
We don't know. I would venture to say it's probably hard to imagine all of them doing this, but there's certainly some. I found that Alabama one, the North Carolina ones in this case, there's one out of Missouri and one out of Georgia that have cases that are still pending in tax court. There may be others out there that you never hear about because audits themselves aren't necessarily public. So this has happened. It's happened enough that the Obama administration asked Congress to ban the practice, to basically say, if it's a golf course, you shouldn't be able to get this break, and that didn't go anywhere.
All right, so you point out a couple of, I guess I'd consider them funny examples of people really sort of stretching the idea of the conservation easement tax break. What'd you find on that front?
Well, it's hard to say they're funny. It's, you know, there's... I pointed out a case in the story where the IRS won because a landowner wanted to say that building 30 houses instead of 62 in Virginia was open space preservation, and the IRS and the tax court said, no, that's not going to work. There's a big case that came out of New Orleans about preserving the facade of the Ritz-Carlton, which went back and forth and back and forth to the appeals court and back. These can get very, very technical very quickly because there's a set of general rules that apply, but then there's also really specific circumstances. So in that New Orleans case, it was about how expensive it would be to replace this historic facade. In the North Carolina case, it's about really that threshold question of how important a habitat this is, and that requires looking at how many Venus flytraps there are and how many alligators and how many bald eagles and competing expert analyses from both sides.
All right. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Richard Rubin. He's got a piece entitled IRS Tees Off on Golf Courses' Green Tax Claims. How much money is actually at stake here?
In 2012, overall for conservation easements, taxpayers deducted about $1 billion. So, figure if people are in the top bracket, that's, $300-400 million in taxes. It's hard to know how much are for golf courses, but they tend to be some of the bigger ones. The average conservation easement in 2012 was less than $1 million. The ones that play in the North Carolina case were about $8 million in deductions. The Kansas City one's even bigger, and the Georgia one is about $10 million. So because these are big, valuable properties with a lot of acres, they tend to be really expensive tax deductions, and they tend to draw notice from the IRS.
Right. Is the IRS gaining momentum on this front?
I think this case, which was decided in the tax court last month, is definitely momentum for the IRS. Other cases the IRS has lost, and so there's a whole body of law that's been developing in the tax court and the appeals courts over the past decade as all of these cases. I mean, this one dates back to deductions that were taken in 2003 and 2005, and so as all these cases work their way through the audit and court system, there's this whole body of law that's being built up about exactly which T's you have to cross and I's you have to dot to be able to get your tax break.
Thanks, Rich. Wall Street Journal tax writer Richard Rubin. 20 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. The annual Consumer Electronics Show is wrapping up this weekend in Las Vegas. Here's what caught the eye of tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. He's been in Vegas. Rob, what jumped out?
Some of the products that are kind of interesting and different. For instance, there's an aging exoskeleton here at the show. We saw exoskeletons on Edge of Tomorrow and Aliens. In both cases, they were used by the actor to beat the crud out of Aliens. But the aging exoskeleton would be one that Aliens would actually like, because basically you put it on and you hit the button and it ages you 40 years. So instead of being able to jump tall buildings with a single bound, you're lucky you can actually stand up and walk. The idea is to show kids what it's going to feel like when they get older. And I'm assuming that kind of suggests they might want to exercise a bit. But the but I'm thinking at my age 60, if I hit a button and it ages me 40 years, I'm pretty much dead. So I'm not going anywhere near that puppy.
Right.
They've also still brought out runway-ready smartphone cases. Now, this is really the first set of smartphone cases that are designed to make your smartphone look better as opposed to just making it more robust. And the funny thing about this, though, is you pay $800, $900 for an iPhone, and most of the value, of course, is how pretty the phone looks, and then you wrap it up with a case that keeps it from being damaged. You basically only see the phone when you first buy it, and then when you get rid of it at the end of the period, or if in fact you actually break it. So at least with this case, you cover up the beauty that you bought, and you replace it with beauty that you also bought. I guess it'd be kind of like wrapping your brand new Porsche with the body of a brand new Audi or something, but right. But at least it's you're not losing the beauty that you paid for, even though you're paying for it twice. One of the more interesting things is PopBiotics, which is a firm that's creating an EEG brain scan technology for marijuana users. Because a lot of us saw those commercials years ago about this is your brain on drugs. Well, now you can actually see what your brain looks like on drugs, and it's probably not going to be a frying pan. But that's one of the services you can actually see what's going on in the head of a drug user.
Wow. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's in Las Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show. Take us through this Samsung Super Smart TV.
Yeah, well, Samsung is looking at adding the Smart Things Hub to their televisions. Now, the Smart Things Hub is kind of an interesting technology. It was a startup that Samsung bought to get into the home automation space. And it's an open source platform, which means a lot of the users are actually writing code for the thing. And if you think about, a smartphone as being one of those places where you walk in and you tell your lights to go on and off, that's the goal. But with the Smart Things Hub, if you go on the forum, often what you find is you got to write a lot of code to make that actually work the way you want to make it work. So it's much more of a science experiment than it is a finished product at this point. And personally, I think taking a device that you just kind of like to have turn on and watch and turning it into something you might actually have to code probably suggests some of the folks at Samsung missed a meeting, or they're going to do some stuff with the Smart Things Hub that haven't happened yet. But in any case, I'm not convinced we should be putting a smart hub in the television, almost any place else, but in the television. We kind of like that thing to just work.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
If your job involves a bit of danger, it very well may be on the list of America's most stressful jobs. It was compiled by the folks at CareerCast. Here's online content editor Kyle Kensing. Kyle, tops on the list, soldier.
Yeah, military personnel there, with a pretty high margin, as a matter of fact. Its overall stress score is 84.78, so the next closest is 60.59, so you see, obviously, where this is a very difficult job, very high stress, obviously, as I'm sure anybody who has served our country will attest.
Yeah. Boy, not only is it high risk, high stress and all that, the pay is lousy for somebody taking on that much risk.
Absolutely. Certainly a job that's deserving of a much higher pay, if you ask me.
Yeah. All right. So firefighter is in there with a similar stress factor like an airline pilot.
Yeah, with firefighters, you're looking at something where obviously the hours are very difficult, very challenging. That makes for a tough atmosphere and environment, and environmental conditions is one of our stress factors that we score. Obviously, the risk of the firefighter himself or herself is one of the things that we factor in, as well as the life of the people that they're serving. So those are all very high stress scores for that particular field. And then with airline pilot, again, you're looking at something that's very difficult hours. You're in that small cockpit for very long stretches at a time. Statistically, obviously, airline travel is safer than driving in an automobile, but you still, if you're a pilot, responsible for the lives of hundreds of people at a time. So a very high-stress job there.
Yeah, well, at least compared to a firefighter, which has the similar stress factor to it, the pilots are handsomely paid.
Yes, a very high pay disparity there. Pilots are well compensated. That's one of actually the higher-end paying jobs that we track for the Jobs Rated report.
Mm. We're speaking with Kyle Kensing. He's online content editor at CareerCast, and we're talking about their list of jobs considered the most stressful for 2016. All right, so what else made the list?
You've got police officer, which should be of no surprise. Once again, something where you're taking on great personal risk. You're looking out for the safety of others whose lives are at risk. That's a job also with difficult physical demands as well, which physical demands, another one of the things that we factor in here as well. But then kind of switching gears away from the things that are physical danger, you also have something like public relations executive and event coordinator, which kind of stand out when you compare those two things that are of those high physical danger jobs. And that's because those are very high-pressure deadlines, and also working in the public eye. And public speaking is one of the most prevalent phobias in America, with around 74% of people saying that they have a public speaking phobia.
Wow.
So for that to be your day-to-day work, obviously, can be very high stress as well.
Right. All right. Well, a couple of media jobs in there, too. Broadcaster, newspaper reporter, and lousy growth outlooks for those as well.
Yes, very tough marketplace, and competition for jobs as well as competition to move up in your field are also factors that we score for the stressful report as well. So those low outlooks certainly factor in with those jobs.
Thanks, Kyle. That's Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. 6 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Something for you to mention with friends while watching the NFL playoffs this weekend. The Washington Redskins have a group of stars who are obsessed with spending as little money as possible. Starting quarterback Kirk Cousins, who drives a dented GMC Savannah passenger van to work, tells the Wall Street Journal, "It's better to buy appreciating assets than depreciating. No yachts, no sports cars," he says. Two-time Pro Bowl running back Alfred Morris, who makes a base salary of $1.5 million this year, rides a bike to work. When he can't ride because of weather or whatever, he has a 1991 Mazda 626. Pass rusher Ryan Kerrigan signed a $57 million contract this year for 5 years, but he still shares an apartment with a roommate in suburban Virginia. The average salary for NFL players is roughly $2 million this season, but as the Journal says, nobody seems to have told the Redskins. Washington, the NFC East champs, host Green Bay in a wild card game on Sunday. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
He's in the paint. Down by two. Can he do it? The ball is up. It's nothing but net. The crowd goes wild.
Hey, Greg. Waiting on your PC again.
Yep. Want a front row seat to the big game?
No, I'm good.
A workplace that doesn't work is anything but beautiful. Give your employees the power to do their best work and reduce downtime by 50% with new, powerfully performing Dell and Intel technology. Learn more at Dell.com/business.